And what a panel it is, because quantum computing is simultaneously not a threat at all and a massive threat to Bitcoin. Pause for laughter. Okay. Anyway, we're going to get right into it here. This is our last panel of the day. I'm glad to see this room still so full. It is moderated by somebody you've already become accustomed to on this stage, and I'm sure you're accustomed to his voice because he is a Bitcoin podcaster, Preston Pysh. He's the founder of the Investor Podcast Network. He's a general partner at Ego Death Capital. Please give Preston a very warm welcome to the stage, and let's keep this energy up for the last panel. Okay.
Okay, I hope you guys are ready for this one. This is going to be a fun one. Let's have Hunter Beast come out, Muhammad come out, Brad and Jameson. Join me on the stage, guys. All right. The nice thing about this panel is I can say some dumb questions, and I think everybody else will have empathy for me because quantum's hard. This is a really hard one. And there's nothing more difficult in quantum than trying to understand the timeline, and that's where I want to start because this is the number one question that I hear from people when discussing this topic, because it seems everybody has a different opinion. And I think it doesn't make it any easier that people that are real experts in this space have a pretty wide margin as to what they think the timeline is. And so I'd like to just kind of go down the line, introduce yourself, and then kind of cover this idea of what you guys think the timeline is here that we have to act and have something through to protect Bitcoin.
Hi, I'm Hunter, Hunter Beast. I am author of BIP360, co-author along with Ethan Hallman, and it's essentially we essentially want to make Bitcoin more quantum resistant with that soft fork, and also potentially introduce post-quantum cryptography alongside it. And the timeline, I mean, if I had to guess, we might have 2 good years.
Say that again? 2 years?
I mean, that's my timeline. I hopefully am conservative and very, you know, diligent.
When you say 2 to 3 years, are you saying 2 to 3 years for the Bitcoin community to have a BIP that has some consensus in order to start rotating keys? You think 2 to 3 years?
I hope that's the case. Here's the thing. Like, when people look at the quantum hardware developments, like Willow and Myrana and all those other things, PsiQuantum also, their roadmaps, like, are pretty scary. You also have to account for the fact that there's also innovations happening in the software side. So, like, Shor's algorithm and optimizations happening there, where it requires fewer qubits. You might even be able to make use of noisy qubits. I think we need to make sure that we're very, we take this issue very seriously.
Mohammed, please tell me you don't have the same timeline. I want to hear.
I have a bit of a differing timeline and perspective, but a bit of an introduction first. My background is in aerospace engineering, AI, and I worked at hedge funds and now I'm at Coinbase. And obviously, quantum is a very important topic that should be at heart here for everybody that's holding Bitcoin, right? So if we're not having this discussion, something is wrong. We shouldn't be at this conference. That being said, with regard to timeline, my perspective coming from a markets lens, it all depends on cash flow and venture capital influx into the quantum space. I personally believe that there is a bit of a bubble in the AI domain, and quantum development is pending a pop in the AI bubble. As soon as the AI bubble pops, then venture capital firms will then go to the next shiny object, and that is quantum. And per that logic, we will likely see the changes that would come with a post-quantum future in the case that capital does flow into the space, because there has been quite a lack. For example, AI has had maybe trillions at this point of invested capital, while in the quantum domain we have, I don't know, 150 billion max. So it's a completely different game from a comparative front. So The short answer is as soon as the AI bubble pops, which I believe is maybe in the next 2 to 3 years, and then we'll transition into quantum as the next capital raise focus area, and then we'll see the developments. But, yeah.
All right, Brad.
Hello, everyone. My name is Brad Mills, and I have listened to the audiobook Something Deeply Hidden on Audible by Sean Carroll, and that's all I know about quantum. And I kind of am up here to represent the ADIQ Bitcoin pleb who is kind of scared about quantum. I'm sure there's probably a lot of people out there. They're like, what the hell are they guys
doing? We're entangling the experts and the amateurs up here for y'all.
You can't tell because I'm wearing a suit. You can't tell. But, yeah, I'm an investor in quite a few Bitcoin companies. And I remember kind of being scared during the block size wars about my Bitcoin position, because I didn't kind of have the technical expertise to really know the difference. And I was coming at it from like a social and consensus perspective. And it was the first time I was actually scared about my Bitcoin, because I did not know what was going to happen. And those feelings are kind of coming back now with the quantum thing. And so I've kind of been listening to podcasts with Hunter and Preston and Jameson, and just trying to understand it myself from the perspective of my own investment, my own net worth, my own Bitcoin, and what can I do to advise startups that I'm invested in. And I remember Roger Ver really pissed me off during the block size wars, because he was invested in all these Bitcoin companies and he pulled them all towards the big block side. And so I said, you know what, if I ever want to kind of have more of an impact in Bitcoin, I should try to become like, you know, helpful to startups and invest in Bitcoin companies and guide them and help them with like sane, solid Bitcoin principles. So my perspective is I'm kind of just kind of going by the consensus of like what everybody else thinks. And from that, I feel like it is kind of an issue that we should be thinking about how to get a soft fork in at some point, or at least have that discussion very soon, because
especially if it's this timeline. Yeah.
Because, yeah, it seems like if we don't sort of get the conversation, which we are, which is great, we have the conversation going now. You never know when I have no idea how to even speculate what timeline it is, but it should be probably a priority we start talking about, which thankfully we are.
Jameson.
Yeah, I'm Jameson Lopp, co-founder, chief security officer at Casa. So I am the paranoid security guy, and I think about all types of edge cases. And this is definitely an edge case. It is very out there, but it is a potentially catastrophic edge case. So that is what got me interested. I'm not a quantum expert. I'm not even a cryptographer. But I'm optimistic on one side, in that I believe that we have more than a decade before a cryptographically relevant quantum computer comes online, simply because we're multiple orders of magnitude away at the moment, so there need to be multiple massive breakthroughs within that industry. I'm pessimistic, however, and this is one reason why I'm working on a Bitcoin improvement proposal, which does not compete with Hunter's. It's kind of like, what do we do after? And mainly that's because this is unprecedented in a number of reasons, especially because it will require people to actually move funds. So I'm pessimistic in the sense that Bitcoin is ossifying. It may have already ossified. It's getting harder and harder to upgrade Bitcoin. And I believe that if we get to the point where a cryptographically relevant quantum computer is less than 5 years away, I think that we are all screwed, because it's just too difficult to get Bitcoin as an entire ecosystem to move quickly enough.
When I'm looking at the timeline that you proposed, so back in, I would say it was January, Microsoft came out with their Majorana 1 topological qubit processor, and the CEO of Microsoft was basically saying, hey, I think by like 2030, they're thinking that they'll have 1 million physical qubits online. People see that headline, and if they don't know the difference between physical qubits and logical qubits, there's a massive difference. The logical ones are the ones that we want to look at and understand from a numbers standpoint that could actually impact Bitcoin. And even if you have a 10-to-1 ratio or a 100-to-1 ratio of the noise factor taking that 1 million physical qubits down to logical qubits, you're still in the realm of cracking Bitcoin legacy keys. And I think that's also an important piece, is the legacy keys, which it's, correct me if I'm wrong, 3 to 4 million Bitcoin kind of fall into that camp?
Well, it depends how you count. So there's 6 million that are public keys that are available on chain.
Yeah, okay.
But The majority of those have been moved within the past 6 months, so like they're actively used addresses, often used by exchanges and that sort of thing. But there are about 1.7 million paid-to-public key coins that are essentially considered abandoned coins. And the problem with that is those are spread out across over 34,000 addresses with an average balance of 50 Bitcoin each, which was the original block reward. And so the it becomes a question of like how economical it is to get at those coins because it's only 50 Bitcoin per key, and so that's a consideration for like you know the economics of you're building a $1 billion computer and it costs you millions of dollars to run it and it may not be a good to get those coins. One thing I'd also want to clarify is that you brought up the Majorana 1 research earlier. That's some of the research behind it was actually kind of suspect. We have to be really careful about some of those claims because they even had a paper retracted. Also, Majorana, the type of topological qubits they're working on, those are sort of like a quasi-particle, and they're actually really noise-resistant. It's a really interesting strategy they're pursuing because they're basically, there's really little difference between physical qubits and logical qubits in the Majorana 1 architecture.
Yeah, I've heard this, and this is really important because that noise factor might be less than 10 to 1,
right?
Correct?
Yeah.
Which means, and just so we can kind of frame this for the audience so they understand, how many logical qubits do you need to start cracking some of these legacy keys?
Okay, so there have been some also advancements in the software side, as I mentioned earlier. There's in Shor's algorithm. Shor's algorithm, you have a number of different compute registers for keeping the key, and then you have working memory. And for logical qubits, which build on top of physical qubits, depending on the architecture, if you're using a Majorana architecture, that's actually the less. But the Willow architecture also uses neural networks to implement the error correction codes, and those may be a 50 to 1, which is very good, actually. So the bare minimum, I would say, for running Shor's would be 512 qubits. It's better to have, like, AB registers, so 768 logical qubits might be even better. We used to think we needed a lot more than that, like maybe 6.
Say the number again, because the number that I had heard was over 10,000 logical qubits. You're starting to get in the hunt of this becoming real. Is that the number? Is it like
no? There's a researcher. His name is Steve Tipiconic. He's been doing a lot of research into Shor's algorithm with IBM hardware, and he's discovered that so long as you can do post processing, you can also make use of noisy intermediate scale quantum computers, and you would only really need the equivalent of 768. Qubits to factor a SECP 256(1) 6K1 public key.
So I think I can tell from all of the eyes glazing over in the audience, this is a very complicated issue, and there are many different variables at play. There's many variables on the hardware side. There's more variables on the software side and potential of continuing to improve algorithms for how we actually would use Shor's algorithm to try to break cryptographic keys. And this is all the end result of this, the fact that there are so many variables, so many moving pieces, so many people that are approaching this problem from so many different directions, that we can't really predict. Do we have 1 year? Do we have 10 years? Do we have 20 years? The reason why I got so interested in this debate is because Bitcoin is about consensus, and we have to come to agreement that A, there is a problem before we can even start to say, how do we solve the problem? And so it's hard to even come to an agreement that there is a problem that is close enough that we should be worried about it. And then if we take the next step of saying, okay, well, how do we even address it? There is a litany of other issues, especially around the fact that all of the quantum safe or quantum secure cryptography out there just all sucks. At least it all sucks in terms of Bitcoin and performance.
When you say it sucks, it sucks because it's the memory is so large. Is that really what
large data footprint? Yeah. You know, and Bitcoin has a very limited data size of throughput on the network.
It's, what is it, 80 times the size of current key signatures?
Depends on which signature you're using. Yeah,
the lightest signature.
Generally, a SecP signature is 96 bytes total with the public key and the signature pair. With MLDSA, it's more like 4 kilobytes. With SLHDSA, with commonly configured NIST-1 parameters, it's 8 kilobytes, but you can dial that down to maybe 4 kilobytes based on roast beef research.
So just think about it. Oh. You got a scarce amount of block space there, and you got transactions that are significantly bigger.
But there's another factor, though, there's other factors. So, like, performance, like, for verification speed, key generation, it's all slower, it's bigger. And also, with hash-based cryptography, which is probably the gold standard for, like, in terms of security assumptions, you actually can't do XPubs. So you can't, like, derive a public key from another public key. So, like, the entire concept and use of XPubs can't really work with hash-based cryptography. And unfortunately, that might be one casualty as BIP32.
So we're trying to frame what I'm trying to do here on the panel is frame the problem, help you guys understand the scope of maybe like what the timeline is. But what I think is exciting is, Hunter, you've already written it out with BIP360 as to you're proposing this solution to how we can implement something. The consensus piece is very true. If you haven't been paying attention to the filtering debate, can you only imagine the debate that's going to happen?
And that's not even a consensus debate.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. It's not even a consensus debate. But my point is, socially, you can see how much drama and infighting is kind of happening. And I can only imagine when you add in the complexity of something like this, how the community needs to start early in the discussion around, and thank God you put all this work into putting this together. Let's have the discussion. So let's talk about BIP360. Brad, we're over to you, Brad. If you had to try to very simply describe this so that the audience can understand what you were trying to do from a very high level standpoint, how can you put this into plain English for us, what the proposal is or the solution?
Sure. So first of all, Bitcoin is already, two-thirds of the Bitcoin out there are already held in public key hash addresses. So it's already quantum resistant. And BIP360 essentially aims to solve a quantum vulnerability in Taproot addresses in particular. And there's only about 100,000 Taproot keys, so it's not that big of a problem to begin with. But what it is it's the stepping stone needed to give users of wallets the optionality to be able to choose when they go to spend their coins that have been deposited in their wallet, the option to choose which signature algorithm they want to pick from. And this works using Taproot's like script path spend, but there's a complication with Taproot in that it also, there's the key path spend. And the key path is makes use of an internal key that's derived using elliptic curve cryptography. And that's not good because then people could just spend the funds from the address with the key path and regardless of what our script paths have been committed to in the tap tweak. And so I think there will be like we'll build wallets that will include support for SLHDSA, maybe even other signature algorithms. And
you're not worrying too much about the hardware wallets. I'm assuming it's your opinion they'll figure that out. You're just looking at it more from the BIP proposal. Correct?
Oh, I mean, we're thinking about the hardware wallets too. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of different pieces that need to come together for us to solve this problem. I'm very happy that Trezor is taking this problem very seriously, but they're not the whole complete solution. We need hardware wallet support, absolutely. We need software wallets. We need just even a BIP several BIPs activated.
HSMs.
HSMs, of course. Securus is actually really good.
I mean, we'll have to rewrite so many aspects of infrastructure that are used for the Bitcoin ecosystem. Once again, this is why we need to get many, many years ahead of the curve.
Yes.
Are you scared yet, Brad?
Well, not really, because BIP360 allows me to do a really expensive spin all the way back to the same position and be quantum resistant. So that sounds like a good solution. I have no idea what that means.
Help us understand the testing. So you got this. Let's say that we start getting some momentum from the community that this is a great solution to move forward with. Walk us through the approach to test this in a meaningful kind of way so that if it goes live, and just so everybody knows, soft fork, correct?
Yes,
soft fork, okay? If we do start to go live with this as a community, what does the testing prior to going down that path look like?
Yeah, so we actually just turned up a BIP360 Signet, and we had a workshop. My team and the Andro team, we went to TapConf last week, and we demonstrated. And one person in the audience was able to follow along all the way to the end and give us a demonstrate a SLH DSA spend on Bitcoin and Signet, of course, our own Signet, and it worked in Mempool. You could see in the Mempool Explorer that we forked. Also, we had to fork a lot of repos to make that work. All sorts of things, Rust Bitcoin, some JavaScript libraries. It was a ton of work, but we got that far. Now it's just optimizing, and we need to. We actually rewrote the BIP maybe for a third or fourth time now, and we're going to publish that soon as well. We renamed it based on a feedback from core devs and various other things. It used to be called Quantum Resistant Hash. Now it's paid to TypeScript Hash. So we're trying to make the BIP360 a bit more independent of the quantum concerns, but it will be coupled with a SLH DSA BIP as well that we're working on with Ethan and Conduition and Roast Beef and others.
We have institutions now that hold billions in Bitcoin on balance sheets. Have you seen many of these institutions donate capital for further R&D, for further testing, to really kind of shake out BIP360 specifically, or just any investment in research and development in this particular field?
Yes, there are, let's just say, major economic node operators or users that we talk to on a regular basis that are very concerned about this problem.
But is there actual investment happening? Like you noted that, you know, we expect more and more investment to happen into the quantum computing space, which means to make the quantum computers actually exist and be faster. But is there going to be a flip side of investment of defensive mechanisms? Like this is, as a security professional in general, I think the like defensive side of things tends to be pretty underfunded.
Oh yeah, I agree. I mean, we aren't seeing much on the defensive side at all. I mean, I follow the cash flows all the time, and there isn't much of a focus there. And it's typically like you don't start planning until you get punched in the face, or whatever the Mike Tyson quote is, right? Everybody's waiting, but only until there's an actual issue, right, and it's in your face will people start, oh my God, I need to fix the problem. And you can't wait that long, because as soon as you get to that point, it's at the point of no return. Because if you look at it from an economic perspective, right, people are irrational, right, until they're forced to be rational. And an immediate quantum scare forces you to be rational, right? And again, in that case, it would be too late, markets would crash, people would run to sell their Bitcoin, and we'd be in a very, very difficult situation. And to put this in context, let's assume, for example, that the gold reserves, the U.S. gold reserves, they do an audit and they don't find gold there, right? Everybody would freak out, everybody would run to sell their gold, and gold would in turn, for a short amount of time, or maybe a long amount of time, dip significantly. A similar thing would occur to Bitcoin in this particular circumstance, right? Everybody would run to sell their Bitcoin, but the question is, does Bitcoin come back, right? Because Bitcoin doesn't necessarily have the years and years of history and the masses already accepting it. So the timeline, right, if we have in 2 years and this issue comes up, it could be to the point of no return. But if we say maybe 20, 30 years when every institution and government has a significant Bitcoin holding, then it could be a completely different context. And that's why the timeline is very important, right? Coming to consensus now is more important than doing so as soon as we get punched in the face.
I mean, it seems like the main investment that seems to be happening is that there are standards institutes and now some government agencies that are starting to reach out and say, hey, you should really be prepared in the next 5, 7, 10 years. So, you know, they're I guess, exerting some pressure to try to, you know, put the flame under people's feet, so to speak. But it's like you said, like the incentives aren't necessarily aligned because the incentives are so unclear.
Yeah, and one thing to add, I mean, all the investments are going to the machinery side of things. There hasn't been an algorithmic development in the quantum domain for quite some time that has produced any kind of significance, right? And maybe you could talk more about that if you have perspective.
Beyond Shor's algorithm?
Yeah, I mean, that's quite some time ago relative to...
I mean, there have been developments in Shor's algorithm.
I know, but nothing...
Optimizations.
Yeah, optimizations, but nothing of significance, right? Like, we still have very highly computational algorithms as replacements for the post-quantum future.
Oh, PQC is a different story.
Yeah. So, what I'm saying here is... it's still like all, from what I'm seeing, is the investment is going to machinery rather than algorithmic development or improving the current computational load of existing algorithms rather than improving on them. And that's the critical part, is improving the capability of the algorithms rather than the machinery.
I just have a question, just from the investor perspective, right? Like, let's say this does happen tomorrow. And as we understand it, it's the early Bitcoins. It's Satoshi's treasure, Satoshi's quantum treasure, the buried gold. In the 1600s or the 1700s, there's a Spanish galleon, the San Jose, that sank with 6 million ounces of gold. And it wasn't until gold became worth enough value that we would develop the technology to try to go find this sunken treasure. So quantum, you know, if somebody has a quantum breakthrough and it becomes worth investing the money in the hardware... to go find Satoshi's sunken Bitcoin treasure, the quantum Satoshi treasure, whatever you want to call it. I mean, if that happened tomorrow, correct me if I'm wrong, but it would only be those keys, those like 3 to 6 million Bitcoin. The rest of the exchanges, the custodians, et cetera, like they're not at risk. So if we have a huge crash, yeah, I see that's a huge
somewhat
opportunity.
Somewhat arguable depending on if it's been used lately, right?
So yeah, reused addresses are at risk. But I think... from an incentives perspective, this is interesting because you can actually make an argument that by allowing all of those exposed pay-to-pub key Bitcoin to currently sit out there as a bounty, we're actually incentivizing people to push forward to build their quantum computer in order to be able to basically scoop that up. And I mean, we had a quantum summit a few months ago where we had several companies there that were in the process of building these computers, and we asked them like straight up, are you going to steal Satoshi's coins? And they were very evasive, of course, and they were like, well, you know, we'll have to have a board decision about that at the time.
Well, I actually talked to the CEO of PsiQuantum privately, and he said to me that he wouldn't do that because it might jeopardize his government contracts. But then, like, as I was walking away, I was thinking, wait a second, what if the government paid him?
Strategic quantum Bitcoin reserve.
Yeah.
I mean, we already know
it's... treasure hunting, let's go.
It's already, you know, the strategic reserve is mostly taken from stolen, you know, seized coins. So what if we just seize them with a new quantum computer?
But wouldn't that be an opportunity, though, going back to the investment side of it? If this happened and maybe, you know, like, I don't know what percentage exactly it is, but if it doesn't completely disrupt the network entirely, wouldn't it be quite an opportunity to get some cheap sats? Or am I thinking about it?
And to make everybody else's sats very cheap.
I mean, like, looking at the incentive, right, you have to, in order to truly understand the timeline, you have to see how long it will take for quantum computers to be cheap enough to efficiently be able to steal Bitcoin, right? And I don't know, maybe you could talk about this more, is like, is there research specific to the cost to reward ratio when it comes to stealing all this Bitcoin and then dumping it on the market? Because if a quantum computer is of greater cost, then there's no game theoretic advantage.
Well, yeah, I mean, once again, there's too many variables at play.
That's,
And so one thing that we're all trying to figure out is the technological advancement in this particular space going to continue somewhat linearly or geometrically? If that's the case, that's my optimistic best case, that we... the nerds who are paying attention to this can see, like, usually in cryptography, like, all cryptography tends to degrade over many year and decade period and until eventually it gets broken. And if that's the best case scenario for this, is that we see quantum advancements happen at a steady pace, and then eventually we get to the point where we can project out, because we can look at all the different variables and see where they're converging and say, okay, now we have 10 years, now we have 5 years. However, if something else happens, like if, for example, we have massive AI advancements, and then the AI advancements supercharge it so it ends up being exponential advancement in the quantum space, that is, I think, the black pill scenario where we all get caught unaware and very, very bad things will result from an economic perspective on the Bitcoin network.
One of the things that I think is lost on the community that maybe haven't spent a lot of time on this is, let's say tomorrow we go with BIP 360, the testing, you know, checked out that it was a good solution, the whole community adopts it, you got that soft fork in place, and now everybody's got to rotate their keys to the new quantum grade keys. That process of rotating the keys, if everybody went out and started putting their transactions into the next block to try to rotate the keys, tell me, Hunter, what your timeline is in order for everybody to be able to rotate their keys that have $100 worth of Bitcoin in an address. If you have that or more, how long would it take for those people to rotate their keys? Because I was playing around with AI on this question, and I was kind of blown away at the answer that I got back. I'm curious what your timeline is for everybody to rotate their keys.
I'm pretty sure there was a study done on this, and if I recall correctly, it was like a matter of months, maybe.
What did you say it was?
Several months. Best case scenario, if everybody's paying attention and we get the whole ecosystem to upgrade, multiple months just worth of block space.
But, I mean, there is no best case scenario. We know the Bitcoin community. Everybody's very slow, right? Nobody's going to come and rush again. I very much, I'm firm on the idea. People won't move until they get punched in the face. Like, if you're sitting on a little, if your net worth in Bitcoin is 0.1%, I don't think it's really of concern to go and move it to a quantum resistant wallet, which is of issue. I mean, over time.
Well, the answer I got back was a year.
Yeah.
And the reason I got a year is because it's accounting for the larger, assuming the blocks don't get any bigger, which God forbid we go into that argument.
Let's bring back the block size debate.
Yeah. And don't be surprised if that crops back up with all of this, right? But if we keep the blocks the same size, and because the transaction sizes are so much larger, and you got to account for how many people have to rotate their keys, the answer I was getting was a year if everybody went and did it.
To be clear, like BIP 360 addresses, they aren't really any larger than a Taproot or pay-to-win script hash address type. So really, like to deposit into a quantum resistant address wouldn't be any larger. It's to spend from it. So that might be a little unnecessarily pessimistic.
Okay.
But also another thing.
Don't tell them that. We need people to start focusing on this stuff.
Okay. And also, one thing I also want to. Well, here's the thing. Like, I'm really like compared to Jameson Lopp, I'm very white pilled on this issue, because there's also like what I called Satoshi Shield in some of the earlier versions of the BIP, which was essentially the fact that the 34,000 pay to public keys with average balance of 50 Bitcoin each sort of shields the plebs and gives them time to transfer their coins even in the clear, because there's no crypto economic incentive to take, you know, $100 worth of Bitcoin when there's these 50 Bitcoin outputs hanging out there that, you know, it gives us time to transition. When, you know, when the P2PK supply dwindles, you know, once it becomes zero, or if it's ever burned or frozen or whatever, according to like Qubip and things like that, that would be like, I think, a different scenario. But for right now, you know, like Satoshi's coins shield the plebs.
What's a hot topic for you that you're looking at all of this with all of your knowledge and you're saying, good Lord, if only I could make sure everybody hears this really important point. For you, what is that point that maybe it's not discussed or that you think is a really big deal in this space that is pretty much lost on?
I think one of the more nuanced problems could be the motivations and economic incentives for economic node runners, like the ETF holders and things like that. They might be motivated to seek different solutions than what most Bitcoiners might want.
Why would they not be incentivized? Help us understand that.
So what I hear is that there's definitely a big push for burning the coins, the P2PK coins. Me personally, I don't agree with that. I think, you know, Bitcoin supply is 21 million. People have always known that. The markets may have discounted that for some time because we've assumed Satoshi's coins are abandoned. But I think it's fine. You know, I think the markets will be happy to take up coins at whatever price they are. And the problem is, like, if we're talking about, you know, a 50% drawdown and 80% drawdown, like, you know, Michael Saylor's going to be in trouble. It could be a lot of turmoil on the economic side, right? And so they might push for changes to Bitcoin, like burning the coins, that might run counter to what most Bitcoiners would agree with as being like a good solution, in my opinion. That's just, I think, something for us to be aware of. And I think the best way to counteract that is to be proactive in the solutions that we come up with and try to get ahead of the problem and solve it in a way that everybody's happy with. Maybe Hourglass might be one solution, Hourglass being a way to restrict the spend of Satoshi's coins. I know Lop thinks it's an imperfect solution, and he's not wrong, but it's always compromises, and it's just ultimately, we have to make the decisions that are best for Bitcoin.
Jameson, did you want to talk about the thing you were working on in addition to BIP360?
Yeah, so like I said, I'm not a cryptographer, so I'll leave that to other people to actually argue about which of the quantum safe signature schemes are the least crappy. But what I'm more interested in is actually the game theory and the incentives of deploying a change like this. And this is due to multiple things. A, because of how slow it is to do anything in Bitcoin, and B, human nature. As you've already said multiple times, Muhammad, people don't act until they have almost no other choice. And so I think that if we believe that the quantum computers are actually going to be a threat, we need to give people a deadline. And if we don't give people a deadline, they're going to wait until it's practically too late, if not too late, and then we have everyone rush for the exits, and the Bitcoin block size is not going to adjust itself just because everybody wants to be in a safe quantum address. So this is why I think that we need to have a deadline after which you cannot spend a quantum vulnerable UTXO.
There's also one thing on that note, and this is my primary concern. A lot of people holding Bitcoin now are just TradFi ETFs, hedge funds, and whatnot, and they've been promised that Bitcoin is unchangeable, right? There is no issue that could ever come to compromise its security, right? But these individuals, at that same logic, have already made significant amounts of profits. So they could come and say, and these are from conversations I'm having with hedge fund managers, ETF managers, and such. They could just sell their positions and never re-enter. It's like, okay, we've made our money. People are scared. There's this quantum threat that could destroy the very fabric of Bitcoin. And for them, it's like, okay, exit opportunity. Let me get out before everyone else dumps. And that could be like a prerequisite dump prior to anything actually ever happening. And that's usually what happens, like buy the rumor, sell the news. People start freaking out about the rumor, and sometimes the rumor becomes too bad to the point where things don't recover.
Jameson, that was a really bold thing that you said there. And if people, so the question is what do you do with all the coins that weren't moved by the date that you're proposing? So like that's the essence of
Yeah, so, you know, I think that this is effectively a lose-lose scenario, because if a cryptographically relevant quantum computer does come into existence, then one of the inviolable properties of Bitcoin is going to be violated. Either we do nothing, and now all of a sudden the not your keys, not your coins property becomes an issue, because all of a sudden very specific actors will be able to magically have your keys and take your money. Or on the flip side, if we decide we want to incentivize people to migrate by telling them, you know, you're not going to be able to spend in a quantum vulnerable fashion after some deadline, that violates the don't screw with other people's money aspect of this ecosystem, the censorship resistance. So this is a massive economic controversy, moral and philosophical controversy, and definitely a coordination issue, which is why I'm so black-pilled on, like, if we have less than 5 years to deal with this, then we're probably not going to be able to come to a consensus.
Yeah, and a lot of conversations in general about this need to happen on the, like, custodian level, right? Most people, individuals, don't really care as much, but if you're an exchange or a custodian or something, and you're holding a significant amount of Bitcoin, those are the kind of people you want to be talking about and trying to push this narrative to, because they have much greater control of how your Bitcoin is safe rather than the average individual.
I think if we're going to go by the libertarian principles that Bitcoin was founded upon, we need to exercise individual responsibility. And a part of not your keys, not your coins is the fact that eventually, maybe someday, public keys will become as sensitive as information as private keys.
I mean, a quick note. I don't know if, like, Bitcoin has stuck to its libertarian roots, what we dreamed of back when this first started, right? We have governments.
Quick note. That's a...
No, that's my opinion. I know it's a very unpopular one, but now you have governments and institutions that are holding all of your Bitcoin, right? These are the kind of people you have to talk to and convince that this is an issue. And I don't like it, right? I don't think anyone here likes it, but it's become the sad reality of the space we're in. And those are the kind of people you have to talk to.
Bitcoin is depends on your perspective. Not you can look at it like that, or you can look at the opportunities, and you can look at the space where everything is advancing properly and cypherpunk values, like the bleeding edge of Bitcoin, the startups that I'm investing in. They're pushing forward for free speech, personal liberty, sound money, property rights, all these things. I mean, Bitcoin is for enemies. This is just inevitable. This is how Bitcoin is gonna work. This is consensus, and I don't think we should necessarily look at that as a negative thing. I think we shouldn't paint that as, like, Bitcoin has become this. It's just, this is what Bitcoin is now, and it's not an easy thing to come to any kind of consensus, but I just choose to look at the more positive side of things.
The last thing I want to leave with the audience, because we're out of time, is just, I think hearing the comments on the stage, you can see that this is a serious matter. This is something that I think the community needs to take serious. I think it's something that next time you hear somebody say, oh, quantum, and they're just like, oh, that's decades away, if even that. I think that's bad for the community. And I think everybody here on stage would probably agree that just kind of whitewashing it as no big deal is probably the biggest issue that we currently face on this particular topic. I applaud you, Hunter, the work. I can't even imagine the amount of work that you put into BIP360. You guys, give him a round of applause. Like, So with that, the Quantum panel, gentlemen, thank you so much for your comments.